Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, geology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this November the 13th on the West Coast, and November the 14th now on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zones of the United States of America. We would like to welcome all those around the world listening to this show on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and on blogtalkradio.com. Before we bring on tonight's guest, and this is always one of my favorite parts of the week, especially when it's been such a busy week, because we all get to sort of reflect on everything that we've talked about during the week's shows and rest up a little bit. I certainly can use the rest on my voice. I've been listening to the radio when traveling about, AM radio mostly, and you catch these periodic newscasts. And, of course, now they made this revelatory announcement that the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has reviewed the facts behind a case that's been prepared to pinpoint and charge four or five of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay as the masterminds behind the attacks on 9/11. And I've heard commentary to the effect that, you know, it appears that they're going to be able to prove this case in front of a jury. And Rudy Giuliani, a former mayor of New York, feels that they're making a mistake putting this in civil court, that this should be in front of a military tribunal. Well, it has been so far, actually, when you think about it, because the Pentagon played a role in what occurred on 9/11. They had a full stand down of the military, particularly the Air Force, and it doesn't do much good lying to the American people that know that there was a stand down. Now, why in God's name would you order a stand down if the country's being attacked? We had a president sitting in a elementary school classroom in Florida reading the book My Pet Goat upside down. Certainly there was something dysfunctional going on there amongst his lies of having seen the live TV broadcast of this event as he was standing out in the hallway. Something that the very teacher in whose classroom he was reading My Pet Goat upside down denies occurred. We seem to forget the fine points, and I would draw anyone who's listening's attention to a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. It was put together by a group, a think tank called the Project for a New American Century, or PNAC. And they did this in the late 1990s. Urging that we have another false flag event, a Pearl Harbor-style event, so that they could gear up their war machine and invade the Middle East, which is exactly what they did. You want to say that they aren't the masterminds? You want to say that some people that they happen to pick up at various locations around the world to fortify the lie that was planned and written in a book and is available on the internet? They want to say that these individuals were the masterminds. Excuse me, I thought Osama bin Laden was the mastermind. Excuse me, I thought Saddam Hussein was aiding and abetting Obama. Excuse me, I misspoke. He probably was too. bin Laden. You see, after a while, these names don't even mean anything. We can interchange them, probably. We had the long-bearded Mac Daddy that was a partner of George H.W. Bush, who went by the name Osama bin Laden. I apologize to bin Laden for calling him Obama. And then so he was the long bearded Mac Daddy, and then we have the long legged Mac Daddy in the White House. That's every bit as much a fraud. Let's get down to the facts here, folks. They're trying to hoodwink us. And notice that this news comes out on the heel of a false flag event that they just pulled off last week in Fort Hood, Texas. Again, we have more accounts of automatic weapon fire. And they're saying that the guy that shot all these people up, hundreds of bullets out of two pistols, all of a sudden now, none of these other people were involved. And I'm telling you, there's a lot to be brought to the forefront in terms of the truth of what really went on. Now they've got you thinking about Guantanamo Bay. Now they've got you thinking about, oh, finally we're going to get to the bottom of who was behind 9/11. No, you don't form a commission to get to the law. The commission is designed to cover it up. And now they're going to take the findings of a corrupt commission and put that into a civil argument and blame people that had nothing to do with it, let alone the original 19 hijackers that they said were involved. That's been disproven in Dr. Kasem Khalil's book, Wrongly Blamed. Those people are alive and well and did not die on a plane, any kind of plane crash on 9/11. So those are my comments for the opening of the show. I'm disgusted with what I hear mainstream media do. Do they really think that we're that stupid? Do they really think that we're that stupid that we can't see through this facade and the continuing corruption? My God. I have pity for them as they rot in hell. Now, I don't intend to conclude with that comment and segue into my guest, but I'm left with no other choice. I said it. Our guest is our resident science advisor. He appears on Evident Footprints every Friday night. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and my co-host every Friday night, my good friend Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Don. It's a pleasure to be here as usual. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm out in rare form, can't you tell?
I'm
nauseated with the lies that I'm hearing everywhere. I mean, it is so ridiculous. And to say, oh, you know, we're confident that we can win this case. And Rudy Giuliani saying, oh, no, they're making a mistake. They should have this in front of a military tribunal. Like the ones that said 152-foot wingspan fit into a 16-foot hole in the front of the Pentagon. Those are the people that you want to hear this case? It's ridiculous. Any comments you want to make here?
Well, the thing that's sticking in my craw more than the other remarks you made, because it's so hard for me to shed this after having heard about it. I think I mentioned on the show last week, I actually had a friend that was down at Fort Hood when this occurred, and he phoned me within probably 20 minutes of whatever the event was to tell me that something really strange was going on down there. And what he told me was pretty interesting, that 500 additional troops were called up and a squadron of helicopters was brought into that area from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I just think that's slightly overkill for one guy with two pistols, don't you?
Yeah, especially on a huge military base. I mean, why would that be necessary? There was obviously another operation or two going on there, which we reported throughout the week.
Exactly. What was that lady policeman doing there on a military base? That's another strange thing.
Well, they had to have another Jessica Lynch there, didn't they? And we saw what a fraud that turned out to be several years back.
Anyway, I just find the whole thing amazing, but on the other hand, you know what? I got so much good stuff going on in my head lately that I really don't want to pollute it by contemplating on this stuff too much.
Yes, believe me, I'm fed up. And you know, I brought this up basically just because this is now what the mainstream media is pumping, okay? And I suppose we should be ready for some more news about Michael Jackson somewhere in between, too.
I was just going to ask you, what happened to Michael Jackson?
Really? Are you serious?
I really was. I was just going to ask you that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're on the same page. I do want to talk about more positive things. Certainly, you have been, for some weeks now, wading your way through, I say wading your way because I've been sort of an impediment to you breezing through your outline, but we've been talking about hidden technologies and hidden historical facts and the implications that has upon humanity and the resulting lowering of consciousness that comes with that. So we're going to try to raise the vibration a bit and allow you to complete your discussion in that area. And you can begin wherever you choose.
Well, I appreciate that. But actually, I was hoping that it would help to raise the consciousness because of the fact that disclosing some of these unusual facts is at least supplying some sort of a nucleus that people can focus on, and some people are going to say, well, it's just too incredible to be true, and others who are ready to accept stuff like that may say, well, gee, what if it is true? Once you start to unfold in that manner, I doubt very much there's any limits, except for the ones that you want to recognize, on just how far you can expand your consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my intention originally in bringing up all this interesting stuff. But, let's see, we were up to, the last thing we spoke about last week was the three forms of alchemy and how forbidden alchemy, which is really alchemy pertaining to the animal kingdom, results or could result, among other things, in the development of shape-shifting. And that, of course, led us into this whole reptilian thing. So that's where we left off last week. You have any final comments on that? Because I know you're very fond of the reptilian plague.
I won't take us there right now because I sense that at some other point we can probably segue right back into that.
Well, I'm sure we will. All right. In that case, the next thing that I wanted to talk about, which is very interesting, at least to me, is a discovery that was made by a very dear friend of mine who died only last year. And we did a whole show on Gene Savoy, as you might remember, sort of mm-hmm. as a memorial tribute, and I thank you for that, Don.
Oh,
and
that was my pleasure. So, you know, we can talk about him anytime.
Yeah, he was a wonderful guy. But anyway, you know, he was an amateur archaeologist, and it always amazes me how these amateurs seem to be the ones that get things done. And the more professional individuals who are content to sit behind mahogany desks and pontificate never seem to discover anything. But this gentleman went out on his own throughout Peru. I believe it was the eastern slopes of the mountains in Peru where it butts up against the border of Brazil. And he made astounding discoveries. I think it was 11 different cities that he found, which were not even known about. And they were eventually attributed to a race of white people, as opposed to the more Indian type that we're used to hearing about in that region. And these people were identified as the Chachapoyans. And it's interesting that they were white, because even Colonel Fawcett, in his ramblings through that area down there, heard lots and lots of legends about lost cities associated with tribes of white people with blue eyes, which definitely sounds like they were a remnant from someplace else. But anyway, the thing about the Chachapoyan civilization is that it was apparently digested eventually by the Incas who conquered them, but allowed them in their traditional fashion to maintain their previous culture. And these were people that built circular structures, more so than the, what would you call the Incan style? It's more like a truncated pyramid. A lot of their buildings had the sides sloping in and then had a flattened top on them. And that was supposedly done because of the constant threat of earthquakes and gave it a more stable foundation. But the Chachapoyans were very fond of circles and ovals, and they built their cities also out of limestone blocks, some of which were quite large. I mean, I have pictures of some of these massive ruins. And the thing that's so amazing about it is here they are in the middle of nowhere down there in Peru. God only knows where they got the stone. But they always build these things on the top of mountains, you know, which is interesting because obviously they have to lug the stuff up there. And some of the walls alone on these fortifications were 60 feet tall. And it's just utterly amazing that this was going on, you know, in that ancient time in South America. And, of course, the reason I bring it up is to enlighten people to the fact that, hey, everything that you're taught is not all there is. And when it comes to this particular situation with the Chachapoyans, the largest city that he discovered, which I understand is now being excavated professionally by the Peruvian government, was larger than Manhattan. Now, that doesn't mean that it had skyscrapers, but what I mean is that Manhattan is, what, roughly 3 miles by 5 miles or three miles by 8 miles, something like that, the island of Manhattan. And most of it is all city at this point. But here you had a city in the Peruvian wilderness that was larger than Manhattan and did have hundreds and hundreds of buildings. So, I mean, that just doesn't fit into the normal picture. And if that isn't something worth thinking about, then I guess I missed the boat in picking that subject. But to me, it's an amazing reality, and it should grab the attention of all of us, wouldn't you think, Don?
Yeah. Now, one of your comments provoked a question that I have to ask. You knew it was coming. The Chachapoyas being white, and you mentioned blue eyes, which stepped all over the question I was going to ask. Was there any speculation or any information that has come out since this discovery about this race of people that would possibly tie them to what originally was called the blue race? In other words, the Caucasian race or the white race on this planet is said to come originally from what was known as the blue race. And I'm thinking that quite possibly that would have been a race that was out in space and other places as well, you know, on other planets, and would have traveled and come here at a particular time in history, and over time the skin color changed, but they were called the blue bloods at one point because the blueness of the skin had a lot to do with how much of their veins actually showed, you know, the process of oxygenation of the blood causes the blood to turn red. But there was sort of a bluish tinge to the skin as well. Any information along that line, or am I just sort of, you know, shooting blanks in the dark?
Well, I don't know if you're shooting blanks or not. I always try to answer these questions based on what I do know. rather than what I think. And frankly, I have heard of the Blue Rays, but I never heard any association between them and the Chachapoyans. What I can tell you, though, which I think is extremely exciting, if you look on the map of eastern Peru, of course, you'd have to probably find one of Gene's books to pinpoint where some of these cities are.
Mm-hmm.
But you will find that they are quite a ways inland. I mean, you're not talking about anything that's on any major river or on any major body of water. The one giant city or civilization was near a very large lake, but that lake was landlocked. And the reason I bring this up is because on the mountain crest that was opposite this giant lake, they noticed that there were burial chambers built up on the cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually like, it was like actually like a burial city built into the cliff. And
sort of like a mausoleum.
Exactly. And they were individual ones. I mean, you know, there were hundreds of them, so they've obviously been burying people that way for quite some time. But anyway, in the midst of all of this, they found a cave, and they managed to climb up to explore the contents of the cave. And there wasn't too much in there, you know, aside from skeletons and some sarcophagi. But what was at the far end of this alcove, which was really exciting, was a large stele about the size of a mattress from a bed. I mean, that's how big it was. And it was completely covered with writing. And this was something that they had not encountered previously. There didn't seem to be any writings in the buildings or anywhere that they had discovered. But in this cave, they did find that. And Gene had been pretty thorough in his preparations for the expedition, and they had brought with them, just in case they found something of that sort, a kind of a rubber compound that apparently you can paint on to something like that. And when it hardens, you can gently pull it off. I guess they have to put some kind of release material on there first, and then you paint this stuff on. You pull it off, and when it's hard, and you roll it up into, you know, a cylinder, and that way, you, without moving the massive thing, you can take back, you know, the imprint of what was on there, and then you can make a casting of the whole thing and reproduce it elsewhere. And they mm-hmm. and they did do that. And Brigham Young University made the first attempt at translating these symbols. And they said the nearest language that they could recognize was Phoenician, but that these symbols were pre-Phoenician in the sense that they Phoenician may have descended from this language, but it predated the Phoenician language. And this is really fascinating because, you know, Phoenicia was all the way on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing that there would be a tie between this remote area in the mountains of Peru and the Phoenician civilization, which, of course, is also gone. But the one thing that's interesting is that the Phoenicians were known as exquisite adventurers and sailors and did an awful lot of exploring. As a matter of fact, we found in Phoenician writing, I don't mean we, meaning me, but Americans have found Phoenician writing on cliffs along the Mississippi. So, you know, those guys were everywhere. And it just goes to show you there's a whole nother aspect of history, which is either ignored or suppressed. I'm not sure which. But that just fascinates me to no end.
Yeah, I would suggest probably both. Both ignored and both suppressed. And it also resounds of this connection with Montauk as well.
I'm not too familiar with Montauk, except for that one book that was written by that fellow up there. I forget his name right now.
Preston Nichols, are you thinking of?
Yeah, Preston Nichols. I met him on several occasions. He's a very interesting guy. But I was not privileged to be involved with whatever he was investigating at Montauk.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that tie in with the Phoenicians?
Well, you're saying, you know, the Phoenicians predated what went on in Egypt, right?
I'm not sure about that.
I would venture that there's got to be some connection to Montauk through the Montauk Indians and the family of the Montauk Indians being named Pharaoh. This was an obsession. I sense this area that you're talking about likely has a portal or several portals, and to be so adept at habitating and constructing things at such high altitudes. As you would have in the Andes, that likely they had some advanced technologies that probably mirrored some of the construction that went on in Egypt. Speculation on my part, but it seems I sense that there's a connection somehow.
Well, the largest connection, which is actually prevalent in lots of areas in South America, even in Machu Picchu, which has become pretty much of a tourist trap nowadays, is the fact that if you look at the stonework, you'll see that there's very distinctly two separate styles of stonework there. The foundations to a lot of these things are monolithic or cycloptean, meaning that they are composed of gigantic stones, and indicating that more than likely, since the style of the cut and the way the things are arranged, they're more like bricks, the way they're cut, you know, square and meant to go together type of thing. And so they probably represent the remains of buildings that were there before the Incas decided to build. And they were obviously aware of the location, went back in there. These foundations were so massive, they weren't going anywhere. So they just built on top of them. And they built with smaller cuts of stone, and their approach seemed to be that rather than have, you know, nicely mortared bricks that in shape, I don't mean literally bricks, but in other words, stylized in their shape, they just fit together whatever they had on hand. And even though they did that with meticulous accuracy, they didn't stick to a single design for the stones. Whatever they had handy, they cut them to fit whatever was already there. So you can see that there's two very distinctly different styles involved in that. And that's something that appears in a lot of the ruins that are discovered, that there's more than one style there, which seems to indicate an earlier period where, you know, the area was used by somebody else before the Incas got there. Now, I don't know if that's true of the Chachapoyan civilization, but Tiwanaku and Puna Puna and places like that show incredible stonework. And some of the things, that, like Tiwanaku, I believe, is around the 14,000-foot mark. And yet when it was excavated and examined, it seemed as if a lot of it was designed as a seaport. Well, you know, the ocean is considerably lower than 14,000 feet. So it really makes people wonder what the story was. And there was a couple of guys that did an analysis and thought that Tiwanaku had actually been built on a bay that was at sea level. And whenever the cataclysm that destroyed Atlantis on the other side was so potent that it actually pushed the Andes upward to a new elevation, and Tiwanaku went up with it, being pretty well damaged in the process. But Lake Titicaca then became a landlocked portion of the sea that was elevated with the rest of that territory to this new height. And I know there were people that were actually looking at the animal life within the lake to see if there was any indication that they had once been sea creatures to try and find validity for that theory. But it stands to reason that all of this unusual activity definitely shows that the history of our planet is not only more convoluted than they want us to believe, but extremely more ancient. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just for clarification, when I mentioned the Egyptians, I probably should have added, you know, the end of the Egyptian royalty, you know, in terms of pharaohs and that. That would have been somewhere in the time period up to about, I don't know, 300 B.C. Or so. So you're talking about a civilization that was probably around 1,200 to 1,300 years, we'll say, up until about 300 B.C. And that is approaching the time period of Alexander the Great and also Cleopatra, around that time period.
Sure.
So,
yeah,
go ahead.
Well, there are three distinct, probably four, but there are three distinct regions of recognized regions of Egyptian history. There's the pre-dynastic Egypt, which actually not too much is known about, but they're now pretty certain that the technology and the mastery of so many different sciences from Egypt was definitely imported from somewhere else, because it just sprang up overnight. Then you have your dynasties, and I believe there were like 14 or 18, I think there were 18. Maybe there were more, I don't know, but there were quite a few dynasties involved, which were basically all Egyptian. And then somewhere towards the end of that chain, you had the Greco-Egyptian era, and then you had the Roman-Egyptian era. So there's all kinds of people conquering and modifying Egypt. But in the earlier periods, there was absolutely no other civilization that we know of that produced more incredible culture and persisted for that length of time as did Egypt, which is saying quite a bit.
Yeah, there's an interesting point I'd like to make about what influenced Egypt. And the Nile River was known, this is amongst metaphysical circles more than what you're going to find in history, but they worshiped the serpents and the animals that lived in the water. So we're talking about reptiles, crocodiles and certain types of snakes and turtles and frogs and what have you. And they were considered sacred animals, but they were learning something. So there was a double message in that. You know, is it symbolic or is it literally the animals that were being worshipped and used in their alchemy? And you know, we have those stories in the book of Exodus, and talking about Moses and talking about the magicians that the Pharaoh surrounded himself with, and the accounts of them turning sticks of wood into live serpents, for example. So definitely there was alchemy back then.
Well, actually, if you want to read Exodus, there's a remarkable paragraph or two in there. I forget exactly what the section is, but I can tell you where it is from the standpoint of the story of Exodus. You remember when the Israelites came to the sacred mountain, and Moses supposedly went up on the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments. He was gone for so long that they fell right back into their old ways. They went and collected all the jewelry and stuff and built a golden calf to worship, and then they had this big orgy and everything. And Moses came down and caught them in the midst of it. Well, then the camp was divided essentially into those that wanted to follow Yahweh or whatever they called God at that time, and the other ones that were, you know, leaning toward the more pagan practices from Egypt. And I guess the supposedly the ones that were leaning toward the paganism were done away with in some fashion. But then after the commotion was over, Moses took the calf, the golden calf, and burned it in a fire. And he doesn't say what kind of fire or how it was done, but what he does say is that the ashes or the remnant of that was then dissolved in water and passed out to the Israelites for them to drink, so that they would understand the mind of God. Now, that's a very, very deep passage that isn't given a whole lot of attention, and I dare say that most people that read it just glaze right over it because it doesn't mean anything to them. But if you study the works of people like David Hutson, for instance, and some of the other people that are trying to resurrect alchemy in modern times, it has a very great meaning, because when gold is properly prepared and dissolved in water, it becomes what the ancients used to call cosmic semen. And when this is ingested, it goes straight to the brain. The high-spin gold atoms, which are now referred to as ormes, embed themselves in the brain lattice and completely change the consciousness. Now, this is, you talk about changing consciousness. This isn't done, you know, by meditation or years of effort. This is done by drinking a solution which essentially changes your resonant frequency.
Now, are you describing monatomic gold, or are you describing maybe something related to that?
Well, it's definitely a form of monatomic gold. How it's prepared and how they ever got this knowledge, I have no clue. But David Hutson lectured tirelessly on this subject, and one of his greatest dreams was to elevate the consciousness of mankind by reinstating this type of knowledge. And he tried to build a plant to produce this material based on discoveries that he had made at his own expense over many years, and formulas which he actually rescued from the cliff faces up by the second cataract at Aswan in Egypt, because it was so badly deteriorated and nobody did anything with it. But apparently he went up there, photographed it, had it all translated, and found out that they were alchemical recipes. And this formed part of the basis of his work. And he was determined to produce this in this country and sell it so that people could essentially digest this material or ingest it and raise their own consciousness, which would increase spirituality and understanding, etc. And boy, was he stopped with a steel boot. The guy had several heart attacks over it and lost a fortune trying to set up this factory. And every imaginable government agency descended on him for innumerable reasons. And finally, he was forced to quit. So obviously, they don't want raised consciousness. But yeah, it was some form of alchemical gold.
Now, some say the Anunnaki influenced the Egyptians. Others say it was the people who came originally from the Sirian star systems, and they're alleged to be in the sixth dimension of reality right now because of their consciousness and their understanding. But that technology was stolen, and I'm inclined to agree with you that the story of the golden calf is testament to that fact that they were interested in using, putting to use, and it goes beyond borrowing, but I think it became the foundation for the current financial system we have. Actually, it's the same people using it.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, hoarding gold strictly for the sake of accumulating wealth is one thing. But if you happen to have knowledge of a higher purpose and a more subtle use for gold, such as putting your mind in touch with the cosmos or expanding your consciousness or whatever, wouldn't this be a natural tendency for the elite to want to have that power and remain the only ones on the planet who can use it?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to allowing it, you know, out for the betterment of humanity in general?
Yeah. And it goes back, I mean, way before the Egyptians, it goes back to Lemuria as well, and most likely Atlantis. So,
we know there's an Atlantean connection to Egypt because the Egyptians talked about Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is, you know, they described it as a continent the size of Liberia or larger than Liberia. Far beyond the Pillars of Hercules. Well, the Pillars of Hercules were the rocks of Gibraltar, and they distinctly described where you have to go to get to this. And yet, you have all sorts of people that refuse to believe that there could ever have been transatlantic contact so early, and so they choose to interpret it as, when they say beyond the Pillars of Hercules, meaning beyond it as if you were coming in the other way, which puts it in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that that you can fit a continent the size of Liberia and the other countries around it in the middle of the Mediterranean. I mean, it's ridiculous. But that's what they're trying to say. And then, of course, the other argument is that Plato invented the whole thing when he wrote about it as a moral lesson. But the interesting thing is, if you take the Egyptians' writings literally, they say that the culture that influenced them the most was beyond the Pillars of Hercules and across the Poison Sea, and had subsisted there for thousands and thousands of years, and it was ruled by 10 kings. And their downfall was when they decided to conquer the rest of the world. And they had wars all over the place. And then, of course, they couldn't support their own military efforts anymore. Doesn't that sound familiar? And eventually nature got ticked off at the whole thing and decided to teach them an interesting lesson, and they were destroyed in various ways.
Yeah, from things that I've heard from, which are written in the Book of Mu, which comes from Lemuria, there are descriptions of making gold out of water, converting the water into gold, in other words.
Well, I don't know if you can convert water directly into gold, but I do know that seawater contains more gold per cubic meter than anything else on the planet. The problem is that the particles of gold are so minute that they haven't found an intelligent way to recover it yet. But here's something that you might find interesting, Don. I knew a guy, and I won't mention his name because I know he doesn't want me to, who was working with seaweed for many years. And he found out that you could genetically modify seaweed to absorb almost any element that you wanted to collect out of the ocean. And he always had a dream of modifying seaweed in this fashion so that its targeted, its primary targeted material would be this micro, it's nanoparticle gold, in which case you'd wind up with this golden seaweed, which you could then, because of the concentration being so high, you could then process to produce gold. Well, the interesting thing about that is gold is funny stuff. I forget how many atoms of gold it constitutes a microcluster, but microclusters are groups of atoms that if you go below that group number, the element is still gold or whatever you're working with, but it loses all the chemical properties of gold. And that's why people don't recognize these nanoparticles, because they can't be tested with normal chemical agents. Now, the Russians were aware of this, and they made special spectrographs that burned their samples extra hot in an electric arc in a vacuum and produced a double spectra. And the first spectra was garbage, and they learned to ignore that. And then a few seconds later, after they continued burning a sample, a new spectrum appeared, and that was the true material that was in this this nano structure that that they were examining. And David Hudson got wind of this process and paid for it out of his own pocket to have that technology brought to the United States, and paid for all the new samples and all of the new standards to be resurrected in his project, and definitely opened the door to a whole new resurrection of this alchemical information. But the door was slammed shut by our friends in Washington or wherever they congregate when they do these things because of the material that was being worked with and because of the implications of higher consciousness for humanity.
Yeah. You and I did a show. May have been as far back as 2 years ago. Do you recall where we talked about the different manifestations of gold?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do remember that. And I think that was where the, was that the show where I talked about the fact that before gold is processed, it's alive?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that, sure.
So this is certainly something along the same lines, and that's not something recent. These aren't recent discoveries, I would venture to guess.
Well, some of them are rediscoveries in the sense that people that are looking at this stuff now for the first time are definitely not the pioneering people that they think they are, because they're just resurrecting knowledge that's tens of thousands of years old.
Mm-hmm. So as far as your revelations concerning the Chachapoyans, is there any evidence that they had this knowledge or this understanding on the basis of their advanced society?
Well, that I don't know. I tell you what, I was invited to go there, and I would have loved to have gone, but that was at a time when I was really ill physically and just would never have made it. And then, of course, you know, time goes by and things change. In the meantime, Gene died. But they do have expeditions which they take down to these areas from time to time. And most of them originate out of Lima, or at least the headquarters for this activity is in Lima. The strange part about it is Gene Savoy was considered a hero in South America, particularly in Peru, for his pioneering work in finding all of these things single-handedly. And in the United States, they haven't even published it yet. I mean, Gene's organization did, because obviously, you know, that was their mission. But, I mean, as far as archaeological circles recognizing this achievement and being excited and interested in the information that was disclosed by this unusual civilization having been found, not a peep. Not a peep.
Well, and is it any surprise that it was the same as far as Tesla's technology, by and large? You know, same thing. All that.
Yeah, I know. It's just that it's so disgusting because, you know, the only thing that we should be pursuing is truth. And yet there's very definitely a whole secret arm of society which is doing their best to prevent truth from ever being explored or when it surfaces to immediately submerge it again.
Yes, well, you know my thoughts well on that, and so does the listening audience. That's a daily struggle, isn't it? So, I hope I didn't take you off course, you know, with these comments and questions I asked. Go ahead, Jim.
No, not really. I mean, I don't mind when you do that. I think it's valuable stuff. You come up with different points of view, things I didn't think about, questions that are interesting. So, no, I don't mind that at all. But getting back to the original deal here, as long as we're talking about South America, one of the other things that I'm personally interested in, there appear to be reports that surface fairly regularly about ancient animals that survive in some of these out-of-the-way places. Colonel Fossett talked about having seen evidence of dinosaur-like creatures still surviving in the Bolivian swamps down there. And of course, that's a pretty exciting thing. I wish that could be looked into. But more recently, there's been quite a bit of information surfacing about the survival of these giant ground sloths in Patagonia. And I can't remember the the technical name for them, but I think it's monotheria or monothelium or something like that. But these things were like 10, 12 foot high with huge tails, and they walked upright, or at least could assume an upright position if they wanted to, and had huge tearing claws that they used for getting stuff out of trees or whatever they, I don't know what they ate. But the most interesting thing about them that I recall is that their flesh, which was covered with hair, has thousands of islands of bone embedded in the skin itself, which is like a protective apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's a very old concept to have armored skin. So these are very ancient animals, and some of these skins showed up with these islands of bones in them that were found in a cave in Patagonia. And even though they were turned into a leather material, so that in a sense you could say they were mummified, they weren't so old that they completely rotted away, and they were not of the fossil category. And so, you know, there have been several expeditions to look to see if some of these giant creatures are still around. No, to me, that's the kind of thing that people should be doing, you know, to really look for, you know, things like that and relics of antiquity that would have an enormous bearing on our on our disposition and our belief system and on our psyche in general. And it just seems that everything that I feel is a turn on for that is exactly what nobody wants to pursue. And that used to frustrate me endlessly when I was younger until I realized that that's part of the plan. But I just wanted to call that to your attention. Had you heard of that, Don?
Yeah, we had talked about that on a past show also, and I had made a remark. You had said something like, you made a comment like you couldn't remember what they were called specifically, but you described them as being sloth-like, and I threw out the suggestion that they might be the predecessors to what we now call Washington, D.C. politicians. If you remember that comment.
Yeah, yes, I do now that you're bringing up, yes.
And that came to mind again, so I just thought I'd remind you that. Of course,
well,
we have to get our jabs in there from time to time. And you know, the skin you're describing sounds like it's the predecessor to Kevlar, you know?
Yes. Well, you know, that's an interesting statement because Mother Nature usually comes up with all this stuff first, and then all we do is really imitate it in some way, shape, or form. So it's not so surprising.
Well, so...
prehistoric Kevlar.
Yeah, but we did cover that on a past show, too. And, of course, you know, it doesn't hurt us at all to revive that again. You know, we have a tendency to forget these things, and there are some new listeners that are hearing this for the first time.
That's true. Well, the next thing on the list is kind of interesting. I won't be able to expound upon it in great detail because I don't know too much about it, but it's always fascinated me. There's this iron column in India, which is quite tall from what I understand, like 15, 20 feet, and maybe... the girth of a telephone pole type of thing. And it's very ornate. It's obviously been either cast or otherwise worked. And it's embedded in a stone foundation in the middle of this square. I don't remember what town it's in, but I'm sure people can look it up on the Internet. And it's estimated to be thousands of years old. The thing about it that's interesting is it doesn't rust. Now, it's been tested, and found to be iron, but it's been modified in some way that it just doesn't oxidize. I mean, you'd think that right there, never mind raising consciousness or anything else, just the pure greed factor, knowing the benefits of iron that didn't rust, would prompt investigations into this stuff. But I've never heard of anything being done with it. And locally, I guess it's just a curiosity, but the darn thing's sitting there in India being ignored, and been there doing that for quite some time, apparently.
Now, is it a coating on the, you're saying it's iron, or is it in the molecular makeup of the iron?
No, there's no coating on it from what I understand. It's just that the molecules of the iron have been arranged in such a way that they don't oxidize, you know, when mm-hmm. exposed to the elements as steel normally would.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, that's incredible. It's very fascinating. And it's obvious that it's an old technology. You know, it was certainly there for quite some time. It's not recent. But, you know, why isn't that being looked into, you know?
Well, they have to... they have to design consumer products with built-in obsolescence, and otherwise you would only have to buy one car or build a building one time. In fact, you could probably fly several airplanes into a skyscraper made of such a material, and the building wouldn't fall in its footprint. So they can't have that, you know.
No. Yeah, I guess you're right. I'm just out of step with reality, I guess.
Oh, I understand your sentiments on that. Believe me, mine are the same. We can do certainly things that withstand the test of time and the elements, especially when we have the technology and the understanding. It's the idea that this isn't intended to be shared by the masses, nor are the benefits thereof intended to be shared by the masses.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of things that are not shared by the masses, I should have had this item in a different location, but previously we were talking about the possibility of commerce and traffic between the old world and the new world, you know, before Columbus. And more recently, when we were talking about the Chachapoyans, there's apparently a link of some sort to the Phoenicians. Well, interestingly enough, there's also a link in the United States to Egypt. And also there's a link in South America to Egypt. And that ought to be brought out because it's also a conscious-raising tidbit of information. Back in the 1890s, one of the first expeditions that went down the Colorado River on rafts, I forget the name of the guy that was involved, but he made a very amazing discovery of a temple built into the face of the Grand Canyon on the north wall, or whatever you want to call it. Apparently it's massive. It opens up into huge chambers underground. There's all sorts of artifacts and things in there. And he reported it, and apparently it was looked into. And in modern times, that whole area is fenced off, and from what I understand, there's actually been a concrete facade poured over that. There has a steel door in it, and it's under guard, and anybody that goes in that area can be routed out of there or arrested or shot, depending on how the thing is posted. And I think it was only about 2 years ago I was in that area, And I was talking to some locals about that. And they said, well, you know, the rumor persists that there's something there, but the government won't let you go there. And recently, some guys that were biking on the north rim of the canyon were arrested simply because they were there.
Didn't they see some apparitions or some craft land? And in fact, I think you and I did a story on that, where there was a saucer that crashed while they were either rafting or cycling. And when they got there to the other, to the location, the thing was gone.
I honestly don't remember that, but I do remember the cyclists being arrested. And, here's the thing that's so odd about this. I mean, regardless of what's in that place, you know, what possible reason would the government have for cordoning it off, and disallowing anybody to know about its presence, you know, except for suppressing consciousness or hiding the truth about the nonlinearity of the true history of the planet, you know, because the average Joe wouldn't care. I mean, you know, they don't care about most other things. So, I mean, it's got to go beyond the normal reasons. You know, if it was being protected for its own sake, that would be a good argument, except that anything else that's treated that way is usually opened up to the public so that they can charge you to come and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they certainly didn't do that here. So it's a pretty mysterious thing. And if it is Egyptian, it's a long ways from Egypt. And even if it isn't Egyptian, supposing it's Lemurian or Atlantean, that's even more exciting, or it should be.
Yeah, it's definitely most likely something that is a challenge to the Matrix and reveals the truth that has to be protected at all costs.
Yeah, that's pretty strange.
That's the general feeling I get. But, I mean, certainly it's not something that's going to be accessible to the average Joe. What all can people do, you know, in such a place? What can they do to it? Or, you know, how accessible is it?
I don't know, but I tell you what, I have really been tempted to mosey over there and see what I can find out. I mean, what's the worst they can do to you? But I never had the time, so I didn't do it.
Well, Jim, we got to wrap up here in a few moments. I don't know if we're making any headway on what you had planned to discuss this evening.
Well, I tell you what, I can close with a very interesting and short segment, which I think would make some kind of an impact. We have been talking about all this stuff for the sake of trying to elucidate the idea of expansion of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And even though this may or may not have any effect on a lot of people, one thing that occurred to me is, you know, how do you describe when you do have an expansion of consciousness? In other words, if you haven't been there yet, how do you know when you get there? I mean, what's different about that state compared to what you're doing now or what you're experiencing now?
Mm-hmm.
And to answer that question, I'd like to refer to two incidences, one which I personally was involved with and one which reflects back on writings of Colonel Fossett. In my personal life, I used to do a lot of sparring in martial arts, going back maybe 12, 15 years, and I really enjoyed it. not only because it kept you in shape, but because eventually you do change when you are regularly involving yourself with these activities. And the thing about sparring that's interesting is when you first start out, it's the same old thing. It's similar to boxing. You know, you face off against another opponent and you apply your skills in an aggressive manner toward him. He tries to counter what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to describe it. But you eventually reach a point, if you're persistent enough, where you do things that surprise the dickens out of you. I can remember so clearly blocking kicks and punches that I never saw. I never knew they were coming. But part of me knew, and I was so surprised, even in the midst of an actual combat, to find myself being able to do this. And that is a knowing, which is above sensory perception of a normal nature. And that in itself represents another level of consciousness, and that's the reason why I'm bringing it up. The other incident that also reflects this capability is something that Facette talked about. When he was in South America, he was standing in this little clearing trying to use his theodolite to take a bearing. And all of a sudden, he leaped into the air and opened his legs. And at that moment, this big snake, which had been right nearby his feet, made a strike at him. And later on, he commented in his notes, he had never seen the snake, he never heard the snake, he didn't know it was there. He said, but the inner man, that's how he described it, the inner man knew that it was there and reacted accordingly. And that's a really, really striking example of what this other level of consciousness is all about. So I thought maybe that's a good way to end tonight's little session.
Yeah, as always, you have a way of tying it together that it really means something. And all of this that we've been talking about really alludes, as you so aptly pointed out, to a higher consciousness and us really seeing what's going on. When you know these things, I can tell you from my personal experience, when you know that your consciousness has expanded to a certain point, it may be difficult to describe to someone else what that's like, but you can, you can't actually put it into words per se, but you can try to draw analogies that one might understand. It's really something that really is beyond a simple explanation, and yet the process is very natural and very simple. You know, you have a rush of information that flows through you at such a rapid rate that you understand a multiplicity of solutions to many, many complex problems. I know I had that sensation once when I was walking my dog up a mountain in Switzerland in the middle of the night looking up at the stars. And there was this moment where my concentration wasn't really on anything. I was in that moment so much that I tapped into that knowledge, and I can only describe it as a million or more concepts and ideas that flowed through my being, and for a few fleeting seconds I understood everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then as soon as I put my mind on that, it started slipping away, but I can still recall the feeling and the process, how it occurred. And I suppose on some level that all that information eventually has a way of manifesting itself in your reality, in your existence. If you pay attention to it, you can recognize it.
Well, it certainly does. And I can tell you this, too, which is a very exciting thing that also I've experienced personally. when you are fortunate enough to latch on to one of those fleeting tidbits of knowledge that might seem like a grain of sand in comparison to everything that was rushing by you, that you had these instantaneous but fleeting understandings of, once you latch on to one of those things, even though it represents like this tiny microcosm of what's available out there, it sometimes can take you years to decipher the totality of what you were given and then figure out how to structure your thinking and your verbalization of that event to convey it to another human being, and yet it occurred in a microsecond.
Yeah, and in 2 months, maybe 3 months, that it'll be 35 years since that event occurred. But I can recall it as it happened at that moment.
Oh, you're talking about the event that you had with the dog in Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the dog was just along for the ride, so to speak. but I wondered also if the dog felt the same thing. You know, there's that connection that we have with animals that they, you know, they can't share with us on a verbal level, but you still see in their behavior and the love that you feel from that animal that there's an understanding that goes beyond words.
Well, that's interesting that you should bring that up, because people that have lived with animals for extended periods of time, particularly in places like Africa, where, you know, their behavior is not too influenced by modern society, they have come to the conclusion that animals have an appreciation for aesthetics, because like lions and other animals will actually gather to watch sunset. And, you know, that's pretty profound.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, we're out of time, but I want to leave you and the listeners with a thought, since you were talking about nature and the consciousness, and we touched upon a lot of issues, a lot of different topics. Those of us that are in pursuit of truth are enamored with the opportunity to share these things with people who are of like mind or people who are searching for the truth. And, so often we share these truths with others, and immediately the minions come out to attack us, to try to suppress it. And you hear these sayings like, don't cast your pearls before swine. You know, those that don't appreciate it, those that are not of that mindset or anywhere near approaching it. But with all the fear mongering and the deceit that's going on, in real time today, we should probably modify that statement and say, don't cast your pearls before swine flu. And leave it at that. Something to ponder over the weekend.
Absolutely.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for being on the show. And as usual, you'll be with us next week. I have a couple of surprises next week. In relation to the broadcast and the broadcast location, we're going to have some excitement in the background, and so we ought to have a really interesting show next Friday, just for that fact alone.
And I look forward to it.
You'll be hearing more about that next week, as will the listening audience. Got some great guests lined up for the shows this week, coming week, and want to wish everyone the best. In the meantime, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com, Wind Talkers Radio Network, and blogtalkradio.com. Got some news stories posted up on my website, directlightproductions.com. Pay to visit. Some new work coming out in this month's Idaho Observer that you're not going to want to miss. We're going to try to sort out this false flag event that occurred at Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. And it seems we're making some headway with with the stance we've been taking in opposition to these swine flu vaccines and this whole hoax being perpetrated upon humanity. It's had some effect, and we'll be talking about that in some greater detail this coming week. So you want to tune in for many of the shows. With that, I want to thank Donna Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish everyone a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.